Hey, you're listening to the Canadian Asian Missional Podcast. This is episode 9. Today, we are talking about how we can be engaging the contemporary Canadian Asian generation. Let's do this. We got a special guest today, James Yang, who's joining us, speaking about an important issue about engaging today's generation, the contemporary Canadian-Asian context, and it's going to be a big topic. But before we jump into that, we definitely want to find out a little bit about James and what's going on in his life, and especially how he sees himself as a Canadian-Asian. So, James, you know, you have not only been a pastor and a leader in the Canadian-Asian context, you yourself are a Canadian Asian, especially Korean. So, you know, what does that mean for you?
I think being Korean, there's a specific kind of upbringing that you experience. You know, when you grow up as a Korean in a Canadian context or identified by your peers as, you know, not really like them, it can be a very challenging upbringing in some ways, and also identifying as a Christian. There's a number of different things that you experience. You definitely don't feel the same as a lot of the people that are around you as you're growing up, and especially being an 80s baby and 80s, 90s baby, you know, during that time, there's, you know, still a lot of racism. There's still a lot of discrimination.
Did you grow up here in Canada?
Yeah. So I was born and raised in Toronto.
Okay.
You know, I grew up in the Etobicoke area. So predominantly Ukrainian, Greek, a lot of Caucasian folks around, and being a Korean in that neighborhood, a lot of time people didn't even know what Korean was. So you're like, are you Chinese?
You look different.
Like, everyone thinks different. They're Chinese. Your eyes look strange, right? You know, the food that you eat smells different. You know, so just growing up in that environment, I think it was really, really different, probably from a lot of other people in that neighborhood, even different from African Canadian folks that I've known. You know, there's still more African Canadians than Asians during that time, and so, you know, as a kid, you grow up with the stigma that, you know, you're different.
You're almost like a child of two worlds, but don't really fit into either, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
So it was really hard, especially when you go home. You know, you're expected to be Korean and Korean as ever, you know, the most Korean that you could possibly be. So
what does that look like though?
It means when you go home, you speak Korean.
You do the bow.
Yeah, you do the bow. You come home from school, if your grandma's at your house, you know, you bow and you say 안녕하세요, right? And you know, you're doing all the things that are Korean, but as soon as you go to school, it's a different story. You know, if you did that when you went to your school, everybody would start making fun of you. That's sort of the dichotomy of Asian Canadian life, especially growing up in the 80s and 90s. You would go to school and you'd always feel different. And even though people call you friends, they would still sort of poke fun at the differences that you have. And so when I look back at that right now, I don't really enjoy a lot of those memories. I look back and I think to myself, oh man, you know, that wasn't cool. I just kind of put up with it and I didn't realize how terrible that is. But, you know, children can be, you know, as lovely as they are, they can be kind of evil too, you know, when they're, when they're in the elementary years, right?
Hey, I got a quick question for you. When you were growing up in your elementary school, how many other Asian kids were there?
Oh, I'd say you could count. You count with both hands.
Yeah.
Probably less than
a dozen. In the whole school?
In the whole school, probably less than a dozen.
Wow.
School that was probably, I think, around about 400 or 500 kids at the time. You get maybe about 10% of the school that was of color. You know, it wasn't very diverse per se.
Sure.
You know, we were very, very much considered the minority.
Sure.
So the Asian kids usually stuck to each other.
Yeah.
And then, you know, time to time, you'd have the South Asian kids, you know, they'd come and, yeah, you'd have the Sri Lankan friends and the Indian friends and you know, they'd show up and they'd be part of our group too. You know, so all the kids who are not white or black, you know, we'd stick together.
Sure.
So it was interesting. interesting friendships that I still recall a lot of those friendships. You know, it'd be like, you know, a couple Korean kids and then a couple Vietnamese kids, maybe one Filipino kid, and then one Sri Lankan kid and and a kid from India. So, like, we'd eat together and eat all the stinky food that we can in one corner of the cafeteria.
That's your corner.
Yeah, right there. That was our corner where we could be a little shameless. But it wasn't always like that.
Now you talked a little bit about, you know, school and the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Like, what about church life growing up?
Church life was interesting because it was a totally different world. You go to a Korean church and everything is super Korean. It's not even sort of Korean and sort of Canadian. It's a totally different world from what you experience at school or even at home.
Right.
Home life, you're just kind of living this hybrid. You know, you still bring your education home. You're still learning in English. You're still watching TV in English. You're still doing all these things. I'm interacting with my sister, with my siblings, with my cousins in English. But then as soon as you go to church, everything is super traditional. So it's very, very Korean growing up. And part of me loathed it, but part of me loved it. Because I didn't have to be ashamed of that part of my my identity.
It's kind of like an affinity.
Yeah. So there was a certain amount of comfort that was there. As a kid, I don't know if I could say that in my adult years, but I could definitely say that in my childhood, I did feel like I belonged.
Were you part of the EM or English ministry?
There was an English ministry. I mean, my home church when I was a kid, it was mostly people who have immigrated within the last 10, 15, 20 years.
Sure.
Right. So, you know, people are still very, very Korean. And even the English, they call it English ministry, but, you know, you'd have like a Korean pastor come in speaking his broken English and it's more like a hybrid sermon of English and Korean, and usually we didn't really understand what they were preaching. Yeah, and they would sing Sunday school songs, and I think we would probably get more of our spiritual growth and understanding of Jesus probably through the songs that we sang,
right,
rather than like even the sermons,
right,
or the Bible studies where we had maybe younger Bible study teachers who would teach us about the Bible and teach us about Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, let's fast forward almost 30 years, I guess, right? Being Canadian Asian now takes on a new form. We're a more visible minority. Like, we're, you know, you're talking about schools. You go into an average classroom now, it's not like there's only one or two. We're like 50%, 75%. In some cases, Caucasians are the minority in classes. Mm-hmm. In some schools,
especially if you go to the 905.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're fast forwarding. And, you know, for you, what does it mean to be a Canadian Asian today?
I think it could go two ways. You could either be very, very immersed in the second gen Asian community and almost sort of, you know, tunneled into that to that society, and that, you know, there's a subculture of society. I think that's happening with Asians and with people of minority, especially, well, no longer minority, but in perceived minority.
Sure.
But on the other hand, you could have folks who are very, very integrated with many different kinds of ethnicities and of people of all sorts of different backgrounds. I find myself in the former. I think it is out of choice, unconsciously, but I think just naturally sort of the path that has been presented before me and the decisions that I've made in terms of where I do ministry and which direction that I go is that I'm always sort of working with Asian Canadian contexts.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very interesting with what you were describing, this unique subculture in many ways, because then it's almost like you're working with a group that is wrestling with identity their whole lives, because they're like you, but in a culture that is more well receptive of this idea of multiculturalism.
That's right.
Right? Like they're Canadians. They probably don't even have a lick of accent, but they're not really, because, you know, they don't look, quote unquote, like Canadians.
Mm-hmm. Or Caucasians.
Yeah. But they also don't also fully affiliate with the mainstream culture as well. Uh-huh. So it's a very unique context.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now I want to ask a question. James, like, one of your passions and ministries is creating media content for your Theophilus devotionals, first as a blog and then as a video series. And that was a big part of your heart to to reach a new generation? Because you've seen all these different issues and challenges that you're like, I really want to minister to this capacity, not only in the church context as a pastor, which you are doing, but also through this other medium. For you, you've created this content to encourage and to equip others to know and follow God in deeper ways, and it's specifically geared toward a more contemporary context. And, you know, I want to ask you, you know, how would you describe today's generation? You've talked a little bit about it today. Why do you believe it is crucial to be able to engage this generation?
I think a lot of the material that we use today, and there's some great stuff out there, I think, for our spiritual growth and for our discipleship and personal discipleship. But I do feel like in some ways, the North American Christian context as a whole is sort of funneled into a very particular kind of evangelicalism.
Sure.
And an approach to the gospel where it almost feels the same. Everything feels so similar.
Right.
And I just have to be honest, it sounds very white American.
Right, sure.
And there isn't much content out there right now that'll reach a generation, especially here in the North American context, where not everybody is white, Caucasian, European descent, and evangelical Christian. Maybe some of them grew up as a Buddhist, or some of them grew up as from a very traditional Confucian household, or
which is more likely in the Canadian Asian context.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. And increasingly more now, you have people who have grown up in a completely secular family environment where neither their parents nor their grandparents even believe in the gospel.
Right.
It's sort of a daunting mission, I think, today in terms of trying to reach a generation where they're not used to spiritual disciplines as a norm in their daily life. They're not used to praying. They're not used to reading the Bible. And then you're asking them, now go and read the Bible and pray.
Right.
I think it's a very difficult proposition.
Yeah, it's like another language.
That's right. And I think it's so easy for us to just say in general terms, you know, you have an issue, go read your Bible. You
right.
know, it's like you have a problem, go pray.
Go pray.
You know, you know, you should do that on a daily basis. But what does it even look like for a lot of people today? It's a difficult thing for this generation. And the way we communicate, the way we identify with one another has rapidly changed in the last 5 to 10 years.
Absolutely.
People no longer read as much as they used to. You see bookstores going out of business. I believe Chapters Indigo is having a very, very difficult time doing business today because they simply can't get enough people to read.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, media like this, either listening in, something that doesn't require too much processing and work in your brain and to use too much of your imagination. As sad as that seems, that is just generation today. They use their imagination in very different ways.
Right.
What they envision as creativity is a very, very different thing.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because like I talked to someone and they were like, oh, you know, how did they learn to cook a specific dish? And, you know, in generations before, you go get a cookbook. But nowadays, you just go on YouTube and you just watch someone teach you, right? It's a completely different way of engaging specific ideas and learning. Mm-hmm. And you're right. Like culture is changing so fast.
Yeah, the way we consume information in general is getting faster and faster faster, and becomes easier and easier. And if you're still resorting back to like a manual, a paper manual to know how to work something, I think we're very, very out of touch with the time. You buy an electronic item these days, it still comes with the manual, but for the most part, you have to make that product as intuitive as possible.
Right.
Or else it just becomes a failure.
Sure.
Life, in some ways, our technology has pushed us to become a lot more simpler, yet so complex.
Right.
And I think the difficulty is that as pastors and as leaders of the church, if we're still merely just expecting people to show up and where we preach from the pulpit, where you have people sit down and read a Bible and then, you know, extrapolate and create exegesis for themselves is a very difficult proposition. I sit down with a lot of the youth today and I ask them, what does this mean to you? What does this passage mean to you? And they'll look at you with a blank face.
Sure.
Because they have no idea.
Sure. Maybe even let alone where to find it in the Bible.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so helping them process that information in a very different way is very, very important, the way we communicate. Jesus did the exact same thing. I think Jesus was very cutting edge during that time, you know, sharing in parables.
Right.
And even all the teachers in the law and the Sadducees and the priests who gather around to hear the man preach, I think were asking, why does this guy speak in parables all the time? And we see that in the scripture. And it was not a norm. It was not a norm for people to speak that way, to be a storyteller and to use those parables at the time. And I think as the generation changes today, we're looking at what is the new parable?
Right.
What is the new parable today?
Nice, yeah.
How do we have people begin to listen to the gospel in a way that's palatable and a way for them to hear?
Sure.
And I think that's my struggle. I tried, you know, the very beginning of my online endeavor, I think, was me writing. And then I think over time, at the beginning, I saw a very, very large spike in readership. And
sure.
And I looked at the demographic and I looked at the age group of who was reading this stuff. And I realized I was reaching people my father's age and my mother's age. And I was like, that's not exactly who I'm looking for.
Sure, yeah, right? Yeah.
And that's not who I'm trying. And so I stopped.
Right.
I got burnt out. I was like, they're not reading this stuff, sure. Right? And if they do, they'll read the really short stuff. And if I write anything more than two paragraphs, they won't read it. They have enough to read at school. They have enough to read at work. And they're not going to read this stuff.
Yeah.
So I stopped. And I thought to myself, okay, how do I do this for an entire year? That year and a half, I started asking, how do people identify with the Bible today?
Right.
How are people consuming information? How are people thinking, and how do you stimulate creative thinking and spirituality in people's lives? And that's not to say I'm trying to manufacture some sort of spirituality, right, right. But I'm trying to identify with people of this generation. And I think the reality is it's for us as pastors today, we have to put in a lot of work.
Yeah.
We have to start thinking outside the box of the old, you know, days of, you know, Calvin and Wesley and where they were going around as itinerant preachers and writing out their sermons, and like Spurgeon, who would write books and books, you know, right, sermons. Yeah. And that's no longer the context of today's generation. It was a very literate generation back then, a very scholarly culture. But today, that's not the case. It's very media driven. Everything is moving very, very fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at sort of the new video series that I've started on YouTube, it's some might feel like, especially those of us who are a little older, might feel like, okay, this information is going really fast.
Right.
So, you know, I'm constantly cutting it so it becomes extremely simple.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how a lot of my young people in my youth group and in my college group at the church are saying, I identify with that.
Right.
It's much better for me.
Sure.
I'm getting something out of this.
Right.
And it spoke to some of them, especially in very, very critical times of need.
Mm.
And so I'm beginning to think, okay, is this something that I need to continue to do and continue to grow in understanding how is this generation connecting? How are they communicating? How do they receive information? How do they identify with the truth? And understanding their context more and the way they've been brought up and the way they think.
Yeah.
So I think that is my burden and struggle, I think, right now.
Sure. Now, what do you think is going to happen if ministries and especially pastors are not doing that hard work of understanding the context, of really finding those avenues to connect and engage with others? Like, what do you think is the ultimate outcome?
I think the church can easily grow out of touch with society, and increasingly it has. And we see, even in my denomination alone, you know, I'm part of the Presbyterian Church in Canada, and I would say like the majority of our churches in our denomination are rural, and they are people in their 70s and 80s and even their 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And the most prevalent ministry is bingo night, or if
yeah.
it's a funeral.
That's like, that will be what it is for the ministries. It'll be a funeral for the ministries as well.
That's right. And I don't mean that out of any disrespect, but that is the reality of our context today, where our most of our congregations right now are turning silver hair and actually dying out. And so my struggle is, do we become that generation where we no longer can identify with the younger people anymore, and then we become completely irrelevant? Some of the people I talk to is like, well, the church is not about being relevant. But I think that's an excuse for the church to not change their way and the way they communicate, and to be in that comfortable zone, that spot, and to preserve their heritage and tradition rather than pushing forward to see the gospel expand.
Yeah.
And so I think it's very dangerous for a church to continue in the traditional way.
Yeah.
If we don't begin to adjust and begin to change, then we will be rendered irrelevant.
Sure.
And it's not because of our spirituality. It has nothing to do with because we're being strong Christians or because we're standing up for our faith, but because we're being exactly like the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the teachers of the law of the New Testament, that they've lost touch with the needs of the culture.
Sure.
And they've held on to tradition more than they've held on to the people, and to love them and to care for them and to be compassionate to the people that they've been given as their congregation, as the parishioners.
Now, let me ask you something. How have you seen, you know, the youth and the young adults that you work with respond to Korean traditions?
It goes both ways. I think to some degree, there are certain Korean traditions they take a lot of pride in because that's how they grew up. And it's a sense of social identity that they can celebrate and say, this is my heritage, where I've been, who I am, how I grew up. And there's a certain amount of pride.
Sure.
I think we're seeing much more of that, as there is a lot less shame in celebrating that today.
Okay.
You're seeing a lot more of that with the younger generation, who celebrate being more Korean or celebrate being more Chinese and love being Chinese and love being Korean. But I cannot say that about my age group.
Right.
Where we grew up in a culture of shame, feeling like a minority and feeling like if I show up with a bowl of rice and kimchi to our lunchroom, you know, we'd be shunned to the corner of a hallway that where no one was, and we'd have
in
to
the
eat
dark.
Yeah, in the secret, or even the washroom. Yeah, quite literally.
That's true. That's true.
And now it's you know, where mainstream media today is even celebrating that Asianness. Mm-hmm. You know, K-pop is on the rise, and
it's global.
It's totally mainstream now, and so you see people saying, "Oh, you know, it's K-pop is huge," and so you're seeing the prevalent sort of culture that is beginning to be, you know, identified, you know, in our mainstream North American culture now as a norm of Asian food being quite the staple and the norm. You know, now you go down in New York and people say, if you don't eat Korean food and if you don't eat Chinese food, you're not a real New Yorker, right? And, you know, if
you've missed out too.
Yeah, and if you're in California and you don't eat tacos, you don't eat Mexican food, and you don't eat real Mexican food, and you're going to Taco Bell, you're not a real Californian, right? So the culture is rapidly changing, sure, where minority culture is becoming much more lively and much more celebrated.
Sure.
Even amidst all of that craziness in the South, where, you know, all the white supremacist stuff.
Right, right.
I think that's just a reaction to the reality of what's happening in the North American context. But I think for my age group, it was a very big point of contention where we're like, do I go into my workplace and be proud to be Korean? And, and I admire those of my friends who did and say, look, I'm Korean, wear a Korean flag on everything.
Right.
I didn't, you know, and this is a shameful admission, but, you know, I would hide everything. I would try to be as non-Korean as possible. I rejected that for the longest period of time. Now I love it. You know, if someone comes up to me and says, where are you from? It's like, well, I'm born in Canada, but I'm born in a Korean-Canadian family.
Right.
And I'm proud of it to be Korean.
Sure.
But yeah, it's, I think for a lot of people around my age and maybe a little older, still feel a little bit apprehensive about saying things like that.
Sounds like quite the spectrum. Sounds like, you know, there are some that are quite proud of their Korean heritage and some who may have grown up not wanting to keep it or shying away from it, including young adults and youth, right? Depending on what their family system was like and what their perspective was like. And so that creates for you, you know, and for any person ministering in the Canadian Asian context or Korean Canadian context, it's a big job to try to be sensitive to all different aspects and facets of that culture, right? Because you can't just throw out like everything from the past, because some people might really relate to that, but that might not be the case for everybody. That might be not the case for someone who just, you know, has grown up here and has a very different perspective.
Even having a conversation with you right now, it's, you know, I'm already thinking at the top of my head, it's like, maybe I need to do things a little more Asian, right?
Hey, it's an ongoing thing. Yeah, it's the journey.
And I think just, you know, if we begin to think about the gospel and how we can continue to push ahead and, you know, with sharing the gospel with the newer generations, I think we can easily be inspired with a lot of the things that we see today as, you know, as secular. You know, some people might, that's very secular, but for me, you know, if we look at how worship music in general today has progressed to become such a mainstay and staple for any church, to the point where now you have a musical instrument, you know, companies like Fender doing sponsorship for, you know, worship teams to use their instruments on stage. And I know that's really diabolical sort of, you know, the marketing schemes, but it shows to us how the times have changed and how this generation is connecting and what the worship and the discipleship context means for us today. It's no longer, you know, hymn books and, you know, organs. It's now electric guitars and drums. And I remember even 10 years ago, there were churches saying, no, that's the music of the devil. And now, no, this is like, you cannot have church service without a digital projector. It's like, you know, you cannot, it's absolute must. And now even that is becoming sort of archaic.
Right.
How can we continue to push forward and see God's kingdom expand and to grow into this new generation? And I think we have to be attentive to that.
And I think I've been very encouraged by the stories you've been sharing about how people have really been edified and how they've been blessed because of the devotionals you've made and how they've engaged with it, but also that you've done the hard work of, you know, trying to discern and trying to study and trying to observe and even, you know, even course correcting to a point where you're like, the people reading my blog are, you know, are my dad's age. So I think I'm going to need to go in a different direction. You know, I think that requires a lot of humility and a lot of, you know, a lot of grace in order to minister effectively as things continue to change and as things continue to progress as people are coming from so many different backgrounds, right? Thanks so much, James, for joining us today. You know, to check out some of the awesome work that James is doing, visit TheophilusDevos.com or look up Theophilus Devos on YouTube. It's always engaging and encouraging, challenging for your spirit and for your life. Join us next time as we talk about what does it mean to be a leader in the Canadian Asian context, and especially to be missional as a leader. Please remember to subscribe on iTunes or Podbean, and don't forget to rate and review our episodes. We'd love to hear from you, so please hit us up on Facebook, Twitter, or email and leave us your comments and feedback. Let us know how you're engaging with this episode's content and how you're striving to be missional in your lives and context. Also, let us know how our podcast can engage some of these issues better and be able to talk about some of the challenges we're all going through. You're listening to the Canadian Asian Missional Podcast, and we hope you'll join us next time on this journey. See you guys.